My name is Paul Steenhuisen, and this is the Sound Lab New Music Podcast. For Sound Lab, I'll be asking questions about the music, the ideas, techniques, technology, influences, precedents, and other topics relevant to the particular artist. What are the goals, and how are they arrived at? In this episode, the featured artist is Rick Sachs, the Toronto-based percussionist, composer, artistic director, sound artist, thinker, and explorer, geographically, musically, intellectually, technologically, and creatively. Ask Rick Sachs, 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 ask Rick Sachs, Rick Sachs, Rick Sachs, Rick Sachs. I'm here to ask Rick Sachs. I arrived at Rick Sachs' Toronto home just off Queen Street on a gloomy fall day and was greeted by his wife and partner, the composer Linda Catlin Smith. From there, I went downstairs to his studio full of computers, interfaces, and other music paraphernalia. I had barely set up my recorder when he started telling me what was on his mind.
Okay, so I'm working on this puppet show, and this is like samples of early music instruments that I need for the adaptation of Charles Dickens' Hard Times by Puppet Monger.
So there I was, fidgeting around, trying to get my gear together, and Rick was already talking. I knew he was a talker, but you never really know in an interview until you turn the tape on.
And it actually ties into something that I've been thinking about. So 2010, I was running my theory that the turn of the century takes about 10 years for things to sort of coagulate, and that between 2010 and 2014, we're going to see enormous upheavals in art and culture or politically, whatever. Because if you take a look at 1910 to 1914, you have these like wonderful big new mandates and the sloughing off of the previous century. And I was talking to people, and then they said, oh, no, that's not the case any longer, because with the internet and media and television and the way that communication travels now, new ideas and mandates are coming up. Ideas are floating through the internet and being rejected, and new ideas are coming up daily. And I was disappointed. So I said, instead of looking forward at 2010 to 2014, I know it was happening in the arts in the beginning of the 20th century, what was it like in the 19th century? So I did a quick search, and I found this paper by one Laurie Garrison, Royal Holloway University of London, and her article surveys trends in criticism on three-dimensional visual culture in the early 19th century. Romanticists and Victorianists, inspired by Jonathan Crary's groundbreaking study, Techniques of the Observer, have become fascinated by visual technologies such as panoramas, magic lanterns, kaleidoscopes, stereoscopes. It's very exciting for me to see something that was written about 1810 and the turn of and in that period. So I decided to back up once more. I took a look at 1710, where I found Joseph Addison's play Cato, which is a very famous play, which was probably the inspiration for the American Revolution. And that was written in 1710. And if you take a look at that play, it's got quotes that American political heroes and villains, we give them the credit, but it came from this play. So 1710, a major coming together of thoughts, political thoughts. So
this is what he was thinking about, meanwhile writing music for a puppet show. Part of the reason I was there to speak with Rick was in relation to an upcoming performance, a benefit for Toronto's new music concerts. On October 13th at Gallery 345, Rick would perform a collection of his percussion and theater pieces, including Life in the Factory, Humber River Lock System, Light at the End of the Tunnel, and Fruit Loops. I started by asking him how he got into doing new music that contained elements of theater.
That's actually an easy one. And it's because when I was I don't know, 10, 11, 12, something like that, maybe 12, a summer stock theater company came to my hometown. I grew up in a really small town, 300 people.
Which town?
Mountaindale.
New York?
Mountaindale, New York, in the Catskills. And this summer stock theater came in. They bought an old church, and they made a theater in the round. And their first season, they struggled along. And after that, they had about 10 years of sold-out subscriptions, and people came running. And they did all the musicals. Mm-hmm. And they needed the kid to sing Gary, Indiana, or the King and I, all these kid parts I did.
Gary, Indiana, Gary, Indiana, Gary, Indiana, let me fade once again.
I got to see the life behind the stage, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was really inspiring, and I was really part of it. I learned my pieces. I watched them, you know, the summer stock guys, they have the people that know the roles, mm-hmm. because they can't learn it in a week, and they do a new musical every week. So while they're performing, the same actors that are performing are rehearsing for the next show, and the ones that aren't on stage are painting flats. When that show goes down, there's the day off where the flats are changed over, and you have the set for the next show, and some of the pros and some of the apprentices who knew they were going to play lead roles or important roles, they have memorized stuff. They have it all ready. And the other ones are just backup, smaller roles, but choral stuff. Oklahoma, O-K-L-A-H-O-M-A. And so I got into theater, and I knew, and I really got, it got into my blood.
In addition to theater, another important area of exploration for Rick Sacks is science. Chaos theory, complex systems, and readings in other disciplines inform his work on different levels. I asked him about this, and through this we began talking more specifically about some of his pieces.
How does that kind of research and interest of yours affect what you do creatively? Is there a direct influence?
Well, I
indirect?
Sometimes I latch on to some kind of science that interests me. My Ten Planets piece is based on playing with the numbers of the size of the planets and the elliptical orbits of the planets and the weight of the planets, the gravitational pulls of the planets. And I did some like ooey gooey kind of calculations on my own. I had a lot of fun just comparing, you know. First of all, you realize the enormous differences in size and distance. And the distance from the sun to one of the outer planets is so huge that, you know, you can't even, if I was just going to try to do something based upon like a rhythmic scheme, 2 to 3 or 10 to 1, or you can't, because it's thousands
like
to
ratios,
one.
Ratios, yeah.
It's the ratios, right, of the sizes of the planets and the distances between them and the speeds are so enormous that I had to come up with a non-scientific approach using all those numbers. And I created 10 sets of click tracks. Each set is 3 different tempos. And I improvised on a circular set of instruments to that one set of 3 tempos that would come linearly. It would be one tempo, then it would change, and then it would change, and then it would be 10 minutes, and it would be over. I would turn that click track off and listen to my improv with my second set of click tracks, which is based upon the second planet. And then that would change 3 times in a sort of elliptical orbit. And I would improvise to that while listening to the orbit that I had just recorded. And then did that 10 times.
Right.
So by the time I was finished, I had 10 sets of 10 tracks, because there were 10 microphones, and I had 100 tracks.
Wow.
And I just did a very, very light mix on it. I didn't really do any substantial stuff. I love it. It's rich, it's dense, and it sounds like that things are pulling and pushing at each other. And you can tap your foot. You can find yourself tapping your foot in any one of 10 or 30 metronomic markings, and you, and that's the way that you hear the piece.
Right.
Your reference, like what planet are you on? You
right.
know, and how you listen.
I've heard that before.
Yeah.
Let's listen now to an excerpt of the piece 10 Planets, which is featured on the Artifact Music CD of the same name. So how do these thoughts all connect to become the pieces that'll be heard on the concert?
I see a poster on the wall of Toy Weather. I remember seeing you in, I think it was 1992 at the Sound Symposium in St. John's.
Yeah, that was a sort of a work in progress at the Sound Symposium.
I just remember you climbing up and down a ladder, touching something on the ceiling, and with a
The ladder had percussion instruments on each rung of the ladder. So you hit these as you're climbing. You have a stick in your hand, and you're hitting these instruments going up. And when you get to the top, you hit a big gong, and then you come down playing these instruments again. But that's only one task that somebody's doing. There's another guy on a big revolving table that has percussion instruments on it. There were dancers, and eventually I did the show, Toy Weather, and that had the 6-foot conveyor belt that I designed, which I'm also playing at the New Music Concerts fundraiser. Life in the Factory.
Life in the Factory! It's satisfactory!
Yeah, it's a conveyor belt with found objects and percussion instruments on it, and I do a kind of a rap tune.
Is that an improvisation? Semi-improvised?
It's semi-improvised. You know, I do a solo, a solo with the thing going around and around, and I just improvise the solo, and I play basic, simple pulse melody, pulse kind of trash sounds. To this little poem, whatever instrument is in front of me at the time is what
so
I'm hitting.
So it's circulating, and whatever is in front of you becomes
your
color.
It's on a very speed motor, and the motor is so powerful that it's actually quite dangerous. If you turned it up all the way, this giant object would start to, you know, jump around like a bucking bronco. But I control it. Sometimes I get it scarily fast. Slow it down for the more sort of like the boss behind his mirror. Yeah, it's a little sort of political. I had a good time doing it. And basically, Toy Weather was about complex systems and about the butterfly effect. And one of my favorite parts of Toy Weather was that during all of this activity, it was Paul Hoole. He was wearing a baseball outfit, and he was pitching hard balls.
I remember this. Yeah.
At a sound sculpture, like just hanging metals and wood, and each of them had triggers on them that would trigger thunder or applause or some kind of metal effect.
Samples,
yeah. And he pitched these balls, and I actually bought about 10 hardballs and I drilled holes through them and put very heavy fishing line through the ball so he could toss it, and then when he ran out he could just pull them in and have his hardballs back again.
Okay, so to recap here, the piece Toy Weather expresses Rick Sack's interpretation of the butterfly effect. He has built a variable speed conveyor belt with percussion instruments attached to it, and drilled holes into baseballs which are being thrown at metal sheets that trigger samples on a sampler or a computer. What better time than now for Christopher Butterfield, the composer and close friend of Rick Sacks, to provide an anecdote about the ingenuity of Rick in rehearsal and performance.
One thing Rick's really good at is creating really rapid solutions to difficult problems. And I remember years and years and years ago, I was sort of involved with Murray Schafer and conducting orchestral kind of large ensemble workshops of a piece of his called The Crown of Ariadne. And he had specified in the score that he wanted these instruments that were sort of impossible instruments. You know, he wanted an industrial-sized lion's roar, like bull roarer, you know. He wanted great heaps of metal to give, you know, kind of random metallic noise. So Rick just immediately visualized what this was and how to make it. First of all, we take a vibraphone apart. So we found an old vibraphone, took it apart, hung up all the bars in a kind of massive wind chime, like industrial-sized wind chime. And you can imagine the clatter it made. I mean, it was horrific. And then for the bull roarer, he just got an old industrial plastic barrel, cut it in half, got a hawser, you know, like an enormous rope that had to be 12 feet long, and somehow, you know, anchored this thing and had people pull it. So immediately you have these, you know, perfect responses to these. And it happened, like, in moments.
Very quick.
It just happened.
Wow. Yeah.
You know, he has a way of visualizing, making solutions to problems in a way faster than almost anybody I've ever seen.
Yeah, I
agree. And I would actually say that his own work is a bit like that, too, is that he comes up with things extremely rapidly, but they're not sudden eruptions. They're all part of something that he's already thinking about.
Yeah.
You know, so it seems like, oh, we need to do that now, and that involves, you know, conditions A, M, P, and R, you know, out of any possible grid of things that he's thinking about at that moment.
Another piece on the concert that contains connections between the idea, the instrumentation, the theatrical elements, and how the piece is played is called
Light at the End of the Tunnel. And I'm trying to get a Toronto take on it, so I might be talking about Casaloma. I might say that I heard that there's a secret tunnel at the top of Casaloma that takes you down to the St. Lawrence Market or something, you know, down by the water or something, a tunnel, and I'm going to go up there. I've got a backpack, and I'm going to go explore and wish me luck, you know. And so I start out, and immediately the lights go out, and I fall down this big hole with, you know, lots of pots and pans rattling. And from there, eventually I see this light in the distance, and it's actually a light bulb that's at the end of a very, very long table of percussion instruments. And so I work my way toward the light, falling back down to the bass drum and then up toward the higher end instruments.
Hearing him talk about the pieces, I can't help but think there's an element of the absurd in these works.
Each of my theatrical pieces dance around absurdity, but they all have a real arc to them, and there's a beginning, a middle, and an end, and the end is like a punchline or a fulfillment of that little piece. There's nothing that I do in this show for new music concerts that is absurd in the sense that, you know, I'm mixing metaphors or I'm deliberately denying meaning. No, actually, I think that they're successful because, in fact, they're like these little illuminations of some aspect of our lives or that we all share. The little kids, the adults, the teenagers, people in other countries, they all get it. I mean, you know, like somebody like Beckett and Edward Albee, you know, we all feel like they're talking to our humanity, and there's something that is they're saying about our predicament in life. But I don't think I'm dealing with it in that way. I don't think I'm dealing with it in that sort of heightened sense of the ridiculous. Mm-hmm. I'm sort of just illuminating our daily, maybe absurdities, but not in the theater of the absurd, I don't think.
Mm-hmm. And there's resolution somewhere along the way.
There's resolutions to all the little pieces, yeah. And they're all complete.
Background is an open rehearsal of the Evergreen Club Gamelan, one of the groups Rick plays in. He also works with Array Music, New Music Concerts, The Glass Orchestra, Red Sky, Tapestry New Opera, Queen of Puddings, and the Canadian Opera Company, among others. He has worked with composers James Tenney, George Crumb, Heinz Holliger, Maurizio Kogel, and many others. It's a busy, rich existence, and he always seems to be in motion.
I tend to like to go to rehearsals a lot whenever I can, you know. And some of my best experiences have been watching composers interact with the performers. And two of my favorite examples, you were present playing. One was when Boulez was here for the Glenn Gould Prize, and watching the ensemble throughout the day kind of blossom into this piece. And the other was a New Music Concerts event where Helmut Lachenmann was
oh, yeah,
working with the group.
Yeah.
So what's it like when you work with composers who are really very precise and very clear and very interesting?
It's a great joy to play with a composer that knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
Who is there? It's great to have the living composer there. Anyway, I mean, you get so much insight, and you want to realize what they have on the paper. Now, sometimes a composer will come in and say, you know, I never heard my piece played like that. I loved it.
Right.
You know, it's a different new way to, you know, I'm hearing my. And that's a great thing too. For Boulez, you got to do the work. You have to learn the music. You can't sight read that stuff. You got to really work. And then, when he comes, you get the path through which to execute those delicate and difficult passages. So, it's great working with all those guys. And that's one great thing about New Music Concerts is they bring them.
How difficult is it from week to week when you play, you know, Lachenmann, Kogel, Sharman, Tenney? You know, musics that are so different. How can you get your head around that?
I completely, you know, aside from my childhood experiences in theater, I give all that credit to Raymond DeRoche, who basically taught the techniques that I would need to learn any kind of music. Now, he didn't appreciate or introduce me to every kind of music. He was not into a lot of the minimalist stuff. He was not into... he was a New York, uptown New York, you know,
serialist, kind
who of. I lovingly refer to as stale academic serial music.
Right, yeah.
You know, it's some of my favorite stuff. But it prepared me for anything I wanted to do.
During the conversation, I realized that he was switching effortlessly between talking about improvised music, semi-improvised music, group performance, and fully notated scores written by other composers. He also tends to play notated pieces many times. So I was interested to know how a piece could develop as he learns it and performs it over time.
David Lidov, who is on the board of Array Music and a composer who taught for many years at York University, likes to engage in discussions about how performers get a piece of music out. Do they interpret? do they actually recompose the music on the fly? How do you take that score, which is already once removed from the what's in the composer's mind, and get it back out to the world? Are you doing that piece, or after doing it for a certain amount of time, do you recompose the piece? And I used to argue no. And I'm pretty strict about trying to do what's on the page. But more recently, I've been playing this piece by Rodney Sharman, Apollo's Touch. Beautiful, beautiful vibraphone solo. 20 minutes long. And I recently did it down in the States. And I took a little bit of liberty. I mean, I didn't play it wrong, but I just took a little time here and there, or sped up here and there, or put a little bit of dynamics in where it wasn't written. And suddenly I found the piece to be a new piece for me.
Let's listen to the beginning of Apollo's Touch by Rodney Sharman, with Rick Sachs playing vibraphone. Two of the pieces on the October 13th New Music Concerts benefit were written for something called the Mallet Cat, so I was compelled to ask about it and what it does, just prior to playing an example written for it.
I'd been eyeing the Mallet Cat for a long time because I use samplers a lot, and I like technology, and the Mallet Cat was this, it was made out of steel, and it was very heavy.
So it's an instrument.
It's an instrument, and it's a keyboard controller, but it's in the shape of a vibraphone or a marimba. It's like a piano keyboard that you play with mallets. It's got a lot of programmability and flexibility, and lots of pedals to change the sounds and manipulate the sounds. And of course, having it, I'm like, okay, what am I going to do with it? So I started making pieces, and one of the pieces on there is samples of this thing called the Sansura, which is a sort of German-made thumb piano. Mm-hmm. And it's a beautiful sound, and I sampled it, and I play along with it. I play along with some latched loops, so you can turn these loops on and off on the keyboard. And I play along with it, and I love the little piece.
Here's an excerpt of the Umbira sketch for Mallet Cat. To see the instrument and how Rick interacts with it in this piece, go to YouTube and look up Umbira Sketch. Umbira is spelled M-B-I-R-A. A reminder that the New Music Concerts fundraiser with Rick Sachs takes place at 7 p.m. on October 13th, 2010. It's at Gallery 345, which is located at 345 Sororin Avenue in Toronto. Signing off, this is Paul Steenhuisen for Sound Lab New Music Podcasts. This episode of the Sound Lab New Music Podcast was written and produced by Paul Steenhuisen for New Music Concerts. For more information on Rick Sachs, S-A-C-K-S, look him up on YouTube and at ricksachs.com, R-I-X-A-X. For more information on Robert Aitken and the New Music Concerts organization, go to www.newmusicconcerts.com. Audio excerpts in this podcast are used by permission of Rick Sachs and fall within fair use guidelines. Transition audio material designed by Paul Steenhuisen. In all instances, SoundLab New Music podcasts are available free of charge and may be distributed freely with proper credit given. Thanks to Rick Sachs for his time and contributions, and to Christopher Butterfield and Linda Catlin-Smith.